For 15 years, I lived in Muncie, Indiana. There's not a whole lot in Muncie, Indiana, except Ball State University and Ball Hospital, a testimony to the Ball brothers of canning jar fame. And over the course of the years that we were there, we would get a number of students that would come to the university from Christian homes across the state of Indiana, most of them wanting to major in education, be teachers. That's how Ball State University started. And over the course of the years, you know, you meet a number of different students, and there were two in particular that stood out, because there was a wonderful young, wonderful elderly woman who was at the congregation, who is now passed on, a dear Christian sister, and she was the embodiment of hospitality and friendliness, and she would invite the college students to come over to her house. She was a widow, didn't, you know, have a lot of other concerns, but she was going to give her life that she had left to serving people. That was one way she could serve. And so she invited this couple of college kids to come over for dessert. She had made a pie and asked if they would like to come over. And their answer was, well, what kind of pie is it? And it very clearly was, if it was the kind of pie they liked, they would be more than glad to come. But if it was not a particular kind of pie they liked, then no thank you, we will not come. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight, what kind of pie it is that we are trying to pursue in Christ. It's really a lesson on service. And service is what Sister Lucy embodied in her life. And it's what a lot of you embody as well. I have been rather well served and taken care of quite well by many of you, as you've had us into your home and fed me and my brood, at least the part of them I brought with me, and just been very kind and very hospitable. And I find that you're serving in lots of other ways as well. But I cannot help but ask that we would think together some more about service along this theme that we are discussing in the course of this week. What does it mean to be a human being? What is it that God created us for? To be in a relationship with Him and with one another. And therefore, the great commandment is to love. But as you break love down into all its component parts, it's things like humility and service. That's the component we're going to be looking at then this evening. What about service? What does the Bible teach us about service? I want us to begin by thinking about a couple of very important questions that we need to ask ourselves about service. And the first is, how do you spell that? You know, where I come from in Arkansas, service and service are pretty much indistinguishable. And you'll find two kinds of people, those that believe in service and those that believe in serve us, to put the emphasis in the proper place there. And the difference between this attitude about service, whether it's something I ought to be doing or I ought to be receiving, it comes down to two fundamental questions that we ask, the first of which is, who is responsible? You know, that's a great question that comes up these days. Why isn't the government doing something? Why doesn't the school do something? Why doesn't the church do something? And we're sitting around waiting on somebody to do something and not realizing all the while that we are somebody. You know, that's what it means to take personal, individual responsibility for something. And frankly, I think that's the great danger that we face when we take kind of an institutional view of the church. And I don't mean by that the doctrinal question about whether churches ought to be involved in financially supporting human institutions, but rather our conception of the church as an institution, as something that has a life of its own, somehow separate and apart from the people. You know, the worst example of this that I can suggest to you is a situation I knew in a congregation where This one fella, he just felt so bad, we're not doing enough. And so you ask him, well, should we have more assemblies? Oh, no, that's not what he meant. Should we be spending more money on evangelism? Because 99 cents out of every dollar went to evangelism. No, that wasn't. And basically what it came down to it was, he didn't think we were all talking to our neighbors enough about the gospel. And I think that was probably more a case of projection. He wasn't talking to his neighbors about the gospel. And he just assumes, you know, other people aren't doing any better than he is. And so, boy, you know, if the congregation could come up with some kind of outreach program to reach out to the neighbors and share the gospel, wouldn't that be wonderful? And well, so the congregation accommodated him, try to equip the individuals to go out and do their individual responsibility of trying to share the gospel with their neighbor. And then this brother, he slept so much better at night. He finally, his anxiety was alleviated. He was just tickled pink. But you know what? He wasn't doing a single thing different now than he was doing before. So what made him feel better about himself? Just the fact that he was attached, his name was on the roll of some institution, and the institution was doing something, he could somehow take credit for that. You see, that's how an institutional idea of the church guts the very concept of individual spiritual responsibility and accountability. And that's why we wind up waiting around for somebody else to do something or measuring ourselves by how much or how little somebody else is doing. And we wind up not being Christians, followers of Christ, but churchians, followers of a church. And you remember that story at the end of John chapter 21 after Jesus had told Peter what awaited him, in particular what kind of manner of death that he was going to face. And Peter turns around and he sees apparently the apostle John. He says, what about him? And you remember Jesus' answer. Oh, great question, Peter. I'm so glad you're concerned about John. Well, let me explain to you what's going to happen to him too. No, he said, what business is that of yours? What's that got to do with you? I tell you to follow me, you follow me. And if I'm going to follow Christ, I don't take a poll and see how many other people are willing to follow Jesus. I don't look around in the congregation and say, well, is anyone else here willing to follow Jesus? I'm going to follow Jesus, whether anyone else does or not. I am responsible. And that's the attitude and the perspective of one who is a true follower of Jesus Christ. The other person, hey, it's that guy. It's that guy. You know, why don't they do something? And the other question is, of course, who is in need? And the person that's self-absorbed, of course, oh, it's my need. My needs are so real. My pain is so real. I mean, it's so obvious to me what the need is here. And why isn't somebody doing something about my need? But the attitude of the follower of Christ is, well, this person is in need. And it's my responsibility to do something, if I can at all possible, to help with their need. And so it's two important questions, and how you answer those questions makes all the difference in the world. And so you have that person whose attitude is, it's somebody else's responsibility to serve me, versus the one who says, it's my responsibility to serve them. And so those are the two important questions that we need to be asking ourselves. And I'm sure before you came tonight, you would have given the correct answer to those questions. And then there's two key concepts we need to think about. And that is the idea that love, of course, is in fact service, and you see that demonstrated in a number of ways. The great commandment, and we talked about that on Sunday afternoon, one of the ways we know that we were created for a relationship is the fact that when you boil it all down, the great commandment is to love God with all of our being, to love our fellow man as ourself. And any commandment there is, if it's a command to be humble, if it's a command to be kind, if it's a command to be patient, if it's a command not to steal or not to lie or not to commit adultery, those are just specific details about what it means to love God and our fellow man. And so service falls into this in the same way. And so to love God is to serve God. And so this statement, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, and you can get a good concordance out and trace that phrase throughout the book of Deuteronomy. It's something of a theme, but you turn over to the 10th chapter and verse 12 of Deuteronomy, and we find out that loving God with all your heart and all your soul is the same as serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. And so to love God is to serve God. And you can well imagine the same thing is true of our fellow man. To love my fellow man is to serve my fellow man. Notice in Galatians chapter 5, this is in fact one of those two passages where Paul says, in a superficial contradiction to Jesus, that the great commandment is to love your neighbor. And we can quibble about that and say, oh, well, you know, Jesus said it was to love God first. And Paul says it's to love your neighbor. Well, they're not in conflict with one another. The two are one and the same thing, as we've already suggested. And we'll see an example of that again at the end of our lesson tonight. But in Galatians chapter 5, verse 13, you are called to freedom, brethren. Only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love, serve one another. And so love will manifest itself, demonstrate itself in serving one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, in the statement, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Well, yeah, but where does that say anything about service? Well, the command to love is the command to serve, because all the law, all commands of God are summed up in that one statement, in that one law. But then notice verse 15, if you bite and devour one another, take care that you're not consumed by one another. You know, there's two ways you can serve the brethren. You can serve them in the way we normally think of, or you can put them on a platter and eat them. Now, I've been in a number of your homes. We had the potluck on Sunday afternoon. There was some meat that I'm not sure what that meat was. If I were to guess, none of it was human flesh. No cannibals in the congregation, am I right in assuming that? I would expect that a number of us would be kind of grossed out at the idea of eating human flesh. The idea that you invite the preacher over and say, hey, got something to serve you here. But you think about it. The Bible talks about a spiritual cannibalism. And which one are we more grossed out by? The idea that somebody would actually physically eat the flesh of another human being? Or the fact that spiritually we would bite and devour one another, consume one another spiritually through our gossip, our hatred, our just apathy even. Well, that's not what we are called to do. And so, yeah, everybody believes in serving the brethren, but which way are we truly serving the brethren? But the other thing I really want you to understand is, and I've seen this in the years I spent in Muncie, working with a lot of the students at Ball State University. I've seen it down at the college in Tampa. You get good kids from Christian homes all across the country. And I recognize that their parents, which is my generation basically, that I think we made a terrible mistake in the way we raised our children, because we taught them that service is an important part of the Christian life. And service is not an important part of the Christian life. It is the totality of the Christian life. And people need to understand that when we share the gospel with somebody, and it's the gospel of a crucified Christ, it is a message of self-denial and sacrifice and suffering and serving other people. That's it. You think about the message of 1 Peter. Peter is writing to some Christians that are going to shortly be persecuted, whether it's an official government persecution or their neighbors just don't like them. They're going to be persecuted. And the way Peter responds to their persecution is rather instructive to me, because frankly, if I was going to write a letter to some Christians, then I knew they were going to be persecuted. You know, I'm writing a letter to some Christians in Mexico or Zimbabwe or, you know, China. Oh, I just feel so sorry for you. Oh, I heard, you know, you're having some troubles, and, you know, just try to be faithful and stick it out, and, you know, it'll be worth it in the end. But that's not what Peter says to them. And he says, basically, you do right by God, and you do right by your fellow man, and that's all there is. And if it's God's will that you suffer, you suffer. And you just got to trust the Lord has some reason for your suffering. But you know, the problem when we're suffering is, that's Satan's temptation to withdraw and start thinking more of ourselves. It's my pain, and it's my need now. And that's what gets all my attention. And the extent that Satan can distract us from the pain and needs of others, and become preoccupied with ourselves, then we start asking the question, well, what's in it for me? Is this really worth it? Should I keep paying this terrible price that Christ seems to call of me? I'm willing to give Christ 90%. I'm willing to give my fellow man another 9%, but at least let me just have 1% of my life that's just for me. Doesn't God have something just for me to keep for myself? And Peter says, no. And that's why the great commandment is to love the Lord with all your God with all your heart and all your soul. And you love your fellow man. And you exhaust your life in serving God and serving your fellow man. And then you learn something rather strange and mysterious, almost magical, miraculous, some people might call it. And that is, when you do serve the other, you find out you are serving yourself. That's the best way to serve yourself, is by losing your life in serving others, you find the joy of what we were created for. God does not call us to serve others in order to make us miserable. It's that God is telling us the only way you'll ever be truly happy is to get stuck off of yourself and stuck on someone else. To be stuck on God and stuck on our brother and sister in Christ. And in devoting and pouring out our life in service to them, we will find true happiness. But happiness as an end in and of itself is like a greased pig. You'll pursue it and chase it and you'll never get a hold of it. And that's why that happiness that so many people are looking for eludes them. They're looking in the wrong place. You find it in your relationship with your fellow man, your relationship with God. That's what we were created for. And so your whole life just comes down to service. Well, I think about these young people, like those couple of college kids. They weren't bad kids. Came to Ball State. They'd been taught to go to church, be good Christians, be faithful. They were faithful in their attendance while they were with us. They weren't like some who just show up the first Sunday and get their name out there and then disappear and never see them again. But it's pretty obvious, and I've seen this time and again down in Tampa, start of the school year, you know, one of the things that these Christian college students have to do is I need to find a congregation to worship with while I'm here at college. And so you go around church shopping, if you will, and the very attitude of some of these students, and they've been taught this by their parents, you know, you want to be a good consumer, you want to be thoughtful about what congregation you join, and I'm certainly all for being thoughtful about that. But ultimately, the question comes down to, what are you going to do for me? What services do you offer? I'm here to be served. So get with it, people. And we say, that's a good attitude. Or that's the right kind of question Christian people should be asking. And we've taught them a perverse form of the gospel if we do that. And instead, we need to teach our children, we need to teach our young people, we need to teach ourselves, the attitude of Christ is, I'm here to serve. Now I realize there's a lot that goes into determining that. Your effectiveness in serving is going to depend in large part on the opportunities that you have, the willingness of other people to listen, how spiritual or less than spiritual they are. So there's a lot of things to go into that, but what is beyond question is the fact that we need to have the same mind of Christ, which is, I'm here to serve and not to be served. If you'll notice in Matthew chapter 8, there's probably the most bizarre story in the entire New Testament. It is a miracle that is unlike any other miracle that Jesus performs, and that is a blind man that is healed by Jesus, but he cannot see clearly. And then after Jesus heals him again, he can finally see clearly. And so I asked my students down at the college, I said, why is that? Well, somebody eventually gets the right answer to that question. Why did it happen that way? And the only answer possible is Jesus wanted to do it that way. You know, any other answer is not possible. Oh, the man didn't have enough faith. Or, you know, Jesus didn't stay at a Holiday Inn Express, and so he just didn't have the power or the vigor to perform a full miracle. And after he recharged his batteries, well, then he could fully heal the man. Or maybe the Pharisees had some kryptonite or whatever, you know, kept Jesus, that's just silly. The Creator God of all the universe, he could have instantly healed that blind man. In fact, he could have kept the man from being blind to begin with. So Jesus chooses to heal this man in two stages. And why does he do that? Well, it becomes pretty clear as you read carefully the story as it unfolds. The very next story is when Jesus asks his disciples, who do people say that I am? And they don't have a clue. Oh, he's Elijah, he's Jeremiah. You know, one of the Old Testament prophets come back. But the answer is not, you're the Messiah. That's not what the people think. And so they are blind to who Jesus is. But then Peter, you know, he answers the second question Jesus asks, who do you say that I am? Peter says, you're the Christ. You're the Messiah. And so Peter sees Jesus in a way the common people do not. But does that mean that Peter fully sees? And the answer is no. He's like that blind guy. He's been healed partly, but he does not see Jesus clearly yet. And the very next story that we're told is only when Peter confesses that Jesus is the Messiah, then Jesus begins explicitly to tell his disciples, I got to go to Jerusalem, suffer many things at the hands of the chief priests and the elders, and die and be raised again on the third day. And you remember Peter's answer to that? Jesus, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. Now, I don't know what words Peter used. The text simply tells us Peter rebuked Jesus. Again, he might have said, oh, no, Jesus, your glass is half empty kind of guy. You got to be more positive than this. Don't you remember the story of Gideon and how just with a pitiful handful of people, God was able to bring great deliverance against impossible odds, 450-1 odds. You know, God's on our side. God in one person makes a majority. But no matter how you cut it, no matter what the specific words that Peter said were, what it boiled down to is, I understand better than you do, Jesus, what the will of the Father is. And it's because Peter was still blind, partly. He understood Jesus was the Messiah, but he had no clue what that meant. And until that second stage of healing is given to them by Jesus, and they finally come to see who Jesus is fully and completely, they don't know Jesus. And that's kind of how we are these days. We can be people that believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, that we've committed ourselves to following Jesus. But then we don't truly understand Jesus as well as we should. Or we don't see Jesus as clearly as we should. You know, I think we mentioned on Sunday, you know, the words inscribed on the table here, this do in remembrance of me, the most important words, me. If that's not the same me that spoke that word, if it's not the same Jesus of Scripture, if I have some fantasy picture in my mind of Jesus, and that's the one I'm trying to follow, that's not going to do a whole lot of good. And so we need to have the same clarity of vision. We need to see who Jesus clearly is. Not only is he the Christ, but what does that mean? A Christ who suffers. He's a crucified Christ. And so you want to follow Jesus, you got to deny self because that's the kind of Christ he was. You got to crucify yourself because that's the kind of Christ he was. You got to sacrifice, you got to suffer, you got to serve people regardless of whether they deserve it. And in fact, nobody does because that's who Jesus is. And only then do we have the beginnings of an inkling of an understanding about what it is to follow Jesus. And so notice in Mark chapter 10, there's an interesting thing that Mark does in his gospel. There are three times Jesus explicitly predicts his death. The first one we mentioned there in chapter 8. The second one's in chapter 9. The third one's in chapter 10. And every time Jesus explicitly tells them, this is what the will of God is. In fact, you know, the very next story back there in chapter 9 was the transfiguration where God has to speak out of the cloud and says, this is my beloved son. But he adds those words, listen to him. And I think that's God's way of saying, okay, let's start all over. I told you at the beginning, this is my son. Now I'm going to tell you, you listen to him. If he says he's got to go to Jerusalem and die, guess what? That's what's going to happen. That's my plan. That is my purpose. And now Jesus three times is going to tell the disciples explicitly, the whole kingdom of God is not a kingdom of armies and power and wealth and success, the way the world defines such things. It is a kingdom of weakness, of humility, and shame, and death, and defeat. At least the way the world sees it. And immediately after Jesus says each one of these predictions of his death explicitly, the disciples do something stupid. So Peter rebukes Jesus. On the other two occasions, the disciples, all of them, argue about who's greatest in the kingdom. Think of the irony of that. He's just told them it's a kingdom in which such questions of greatness are irrelevant. Greatness will be determined in terms of who is most humble, who is most sacrificial, who puts themselves out as a slave and as a servant. And so let's look at the third incident of this in Mark chapter 10, down in verse 42. And this is where James and John had put their mother up to ask Jesus for the number one and number two positions in the kingdom. And the ten get all upset with James and John. And it's not because, oh, how unspiritual you are, James and John. It's like, oh, we didn't think of it first. And so calling them to himself, Jesus said to them, you know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Their great men exercise authority over them, but it is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. There again is the very attitude of Christ. I'm here to serve. And the moment we lapse into this thinking, I'm here to be served, folks, we're not thinking like Christ. We're not following Christ. And Satan is tickled pink. Because we are called to serve. And to serve like Jesus. And that means being a servant. It means being a slave. And so my question for you then, and this is the real pie I want you to think about, is how well are you serving? And so I got a pie chart here of the typical life of a Christian. And so I got a little sliver there of the time out of 168 hour week. You know, if you really go all the time, like Sunday morning class and Sunday morning assembly and Sunday afternoon and Wednesday night, 4 hours out of 168 hour week, you know, devoted to our church activities. And then look how much we're sleeping and look how much we're working and got to mow the yard and play ball with the kids and you got to eat and you got to do all these things. And when you look at your life like a pie like this, you realize, you know, boy, that's a very little sliver there up there labeled church. And I start feeling awful guilty. Man. So how can I make that little sliver bigger? Well, I could be like that one brother. Should we meet more often? No, don't do that. Where would we find the time in our busy modern lives, right? And of course, how much bigger can you make that slice? I'll just do away with sleeping. And instead of sleeping, I'm going to go knock on people's doors at 2 a.m. and share the gospel with them. Right? That's a more overt religious activity. Or, well, okay, that maybe that'd be a nuisance. I'll just read my Bible, right? And knock on doors during the daytime when people are not sleeping. But you still realize, I got to eat. I have to sleep some. There's only so big I can make that little sliver that's labeled church up there. And then hopefully there's a point at which we realize the mistake here is in equating the little slice of pie we give to the church to be what we're giving to God. You see this in the collection, for example. You know, I don't mean to quibble about how we talk, but sometimes you'll hear some brothers say before the collection, we're going to give back to the Lord, right? Again, we are giving back to the Lord. The problem is when we leave the impression that's the only giving we're giving to the Lord. And the fact of the matter is, when I take care of my aged parents, I'm giving to the Lord. When I feed my children, I'm giving to the Lord. When I'm putting a roof over my family's head, I'm giving to the Lord. In fact, every penny I have belongs to the Lord already. That's the attitude of the Christian. Well, then why am I putting this contribution into the local treasury of a local congregation? You know, if there wasn't even a single passage on that in the Bible, it's something we would still do. And you know why? Because I'm a member of this congregation. And I believe in what it's doing, the work that it's doing, why it exists. And if it has economic needs, financial needs, I should do my fair share in supporting the financial need, meeting that financial burden, doing my fair bit. And so, I take all this money that God's given me stewardship of, it all belongs to Him, And I have to allocate these resources. And I say, now how much do I need to take care of my parents with? And how much do I need to take care of my family with? And maybe I'm sending $100 a month to my brother over in Romania. But I'm also taking some of that and saying, well, this is going to go to the local church. But that's not the only money I'm giving to the Lord. And that has to be our attitude. Because otherwise you're just going to feel guilty your whole life. Look what a tiny sliver I'm giving to God. No, look what a tiny sliver you're giving to the church. And that's okay. Because our lives do not revolve around the local congregation. Now, that's a terrible thing for a preacher to say. Because that's pretty much what a preacher's life does. It revolves around the local church. You're just constantly, I got a couple sermons to get up and a bulletin and a Bible classes and studying with people. But the fact of the matter is that out of our 168 hours in the week, we actually are together very little in that time. That's important time. As we mentioned, it's kind of a support group when we're helping one another spiritually to deal with our problems. But our lives are centered on Christ, and we're followers of Christ. And really, this support group is just to help me in better serving Christ, right? And so I give some of my time to the efforts of a local congregation. But every minute, every hour belongs to God already. And what that means then is that even the hours I'm sleeping belong to God, and even the hours I'm eating belong to God. So what I'm saying to you is everything belongs to God. Every penny you have belongs to God. Every moment of your time belongs to God. And so the only issue is, how do you allocate God's resources that He's given you temporary stewardship of to best serve Him? And that's between you and God. I can't tell you how to allocate your money. I can't tell you whether you ought to be sending $100 to my brother in Romania, you know, that kind of thing. But it's something you hear from time to time. People say, oh, you know, we need to get the contribution up. Oh, have the preacher give a lesson on giving. And there'll be a little bump in the giving. And then some wag will say, yeah, see, people were holding out. They weren't giving, you know, till it bled. They weren't giving till it hurt. If they were giving every penny to begin with, then the preacher could get up and preach all he wants on giving and it wouldn't go up a single penny. Well, that's just foolish. Because we're always capable of reallocating resources. You know, if I found out a special need that somebody had, I could say to my brother, hey, James, you mind if I don't send you $100 this month, if I only send you $50, and I'm going to send the other $50 to this over here? He'd say, oh, that's fine. We can do that. And if we learn of a special need, then we can say, okay, I'm going to, you know, kind of redistribute the resources that I have. You've done that this week. You don't normally come together every evening and assemble, but you're making a special effort. Well, why weren't you doing that last week? Well, it's not something you can do every day for the rest of your life. We're going to have assemblies every day. Why not have assemblies 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? You can't do that. It wouldn't be practical, wouldn't be helpful, wouldn't be wise. But that doesn't mean your life is not just as surely given to God. Whatever you were doing 168 hours ago last week at 7:45, I hope you were giving that time to God. That may seem silly sometime. Maybe you were taking a nap. And taking a nap versus going to a gospel meeting, well, one of them seems a little bit more spiritual than the other. No, not necessarily, if it's given to God. So notice in Colossians chapter 3, verse 17, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through Him to God the Father. Paul basically says everything you do, your job, spending time with your family, your wife, your kids, at a local congregation, all of that is for God. It's supposed to be. That's our goal. And so the whole pie belongs to God. We're not cutting up in pieces and giving God just one little piece of the pie. It all belongs to God. It is all given in service to God and to our fellow man. Well, does that mean even eating and drinking belongs to God? You better believe it. And I don't say that just because I like to eat and drink. Now turn over to Zechariah chapter 7. Now Zechariah is one of these prophets that came after the time of the Babylonian captivity. The people have gotten to come back to their homeland. They're rebuilding the temple. Zechariah and Haggai are two of the ones that helped them get that going. And somebody, it occurred to them, you know, we've been observing these special days of fasting to commemorate the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem and so on. And now that we're getting to come back and rebuild and fix everything, do we have to keep fasting? And of course, the very question kind of betrays a bad attitude. It's kind of like saying, do I have to go to church on Wednesday night? Well, it doesn't matter what, how you answer that question. The question is wrong. And so notice what the Lord's answer was. In Zechariah chapter 7 and verse 5, say to all the people of the land and to the priest, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and the seventh months, these 70 years, was it really for me that you fasted? That's a question, but it's pretty much equivalent to a statement. You weren't fasting for me. You were fasting all right, but it wasn't for me. Well, how did God know that? When you eat and drink, do you not eat for yourselves? Do you not drink for yourselves? You want to make a modern day application of this? You know, I come to church on Sunday and I worship and maybe even I'm a preacher. I get up and bump my gums about Jesus constantly all day long on Sunday. Look how holy I am. And that really impresses God, right? But God would say, I'm looking more at what you're doing on Monday to know what kind of Christian you are than what you're doing on Sunday. Here's some special fasting that they were doing, and God said, I'm looking at how you're eating and how you're drinking. And those little mundane things that you're doing daily tell God more about what kind of true disciple we are than when we're putting on doing some big special thing. Because that's what the hypocrites do. They do the big special things that get attention. They're not going to do the little things. And so quite literally, eating and drinking for God. Now what does that look like? You know, my next door neighbor is a pagan. And you can go peek in the dining room window and watch him eat. And I don't know that he's going to eat any different than I eat physically. You know, do Christians hold their pinky out just so? And so, oh, he's eating for the Lord. No, it's an attitude. And I can't look at you and tell whether you're eating for the Lord or not. You can't look at me and tell whether I'm eating for the Lord or not, but I better be. And I need to understand God is watching me while I eat. And he's looking in my heart and he knows why I'm doing this. Am I just doing it because I'm hungry? Am I just doing it because I like to eat? Or do I understand ultimately I'm doing this that I might live and serve God with my life? And if I don't eat, I'm going to die. And then I can't serve the Lord. And I've got to sleep. And one very easy way to look at this is simply to remind yourself of the answer to this question. Whose bright idea was it to make you have to eat? Whose bright idea was it that you need to sleep? Is that not the Creator? And so we dishonor the Creator when we say things like, oh man, well, sleep, such a waste of time. Boy, I wish I didn't have to waste so much time eating. Well, God, our Creator, made us that way. And we glorify Him when we receive with thanksgiving the food that He gives to us and the time that He gives to us and the fact that we have to spend so much of it sleeping, that honors God. And I don't know all of the reasons why God chose to make us that way. It's certainly possible He could have created a race of people that don't ever need to sleep. But He didn't. And there has to be some reason for it. And so when I do things the Creator has created me to do, I honor my Creator. And that's just as holy a work as some other thing. And so yes, my eating and drinking is for the Lord. All of that is given to Him. What about if I'm in limited circumstances of some way? Go back to Colossians. And here we're talking about these slaves. Their time is not their own. They can't just do as they please. And what did Paul say to them? In verse 23, whatever you do, do your work from the heart as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. Well, wait a minute. I thought they were serving their earthly master. They were. But ultimately they were serving God. So even the limited service they're able to give to their masters is ultimately to God. And so maybe you're a Christian plumber or a factory worker or a teacher. And as long as your work is honest work and it's given to the Lord and it provides you an income and you can take that money and you can provide for your family, you can provide for the preaching of the gospel, you can do good things with it, it honors God. And this notion that the preacher's work is somehow more holy than some carpenter who's doing an honest day's work, it is not true. We're all working for the Lord if we're true Christians and followers of Jesus Christ. And every hour of every week is given to Jesus, and every penny is given to Jesus. And yes, I have to make decisions about how to allocate those pennies. I have to make decisions about how to allocate those minutes. But ultimately, it is all given to Him. And one final question I have you think about tonight. As we get back to Matthew chapter 25, we said we would return to this text. This is a passage that demonstrates again that you cannot distinguish between love for God and love for your fellow man. You cannot say that you love God whom you have not seen and hate your brother that you have seen. And so we're given a story about God's judgment of the nations, separating the righteous and the wicked, the sheep and the goats on the right and the left hand. And as the people are judged, the Lord says to them, you know, you didn't feed me, you didn't take care of me, you didn't clothe me. And they're like, well, wait a minute here. You know, when did we ever see you needing any clothes or needing any food? Well, to the extent you did not do these things to the least of these, your brethren, you did not do it to me, Jesus says. And so it is pretty obvious in the story as Jesus is telling it here, this is not all of the people of the earth. The wicked here are those who thought they were serving Jesus and thought they had good reason to enter into God's blessed realm of heaven. And they're perplexed. I mean, if you're talking about Madeline Murray O'Hare appearing before Jesus on the judgment day, yeah, you didn't serve me. Yeah, that's right, because I didn't believe you existed. But you see, the response of these people is, oh, we'd just been tickled pink to have served you, Jesus, if we'd just known. We didn't see that you had a need. But of course, they were blinded to the need, the true need that was being exhibited by their brethren. So I've always loved this story as a kid. Because I like kind of mystery stories and stories with a twist. And stories where people get what they deserve. You know, like Cinderella, you know, those wicked stepsisters. They ought to get what they deserve, you know. And these stories where they just get by with it, I just can't stand that. So here's a nice, pleasing story. These wicked people, they get what they deserve. And they're shocked at the end of it, you know. And that just tickles me to no end. Oh, you're shocked. Do you ever notice, why are the righteous shocked? You remember that in the story? The righteous people are just as shocked as the wicked people. Jesus says, enter in. When you saw that I was naked, you clothed me. When you saw I was hungry, you fed me. I was in prison, you visited me. You took care of me. And they're like, what are you talking about? When did that ever happen? Well, to the extent you did it to the least of these, your brethren. You were doing it for me. Why does Jesus tell this story for us? What lesson are we to learn from this? I think what Jesus is saying is, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I'm not bragging about myself. Probably more a statement of how forgetful I am. But I'll have people come up and say, you know, 30 years ago, you know, I had a flat tire and you helped me change that. And it was a downpouring rain, and I'm just so grateful, and I've never forget that. And I just look at them with a blank stare, and I'm like, I have no idea what they're talking about. I don't remember this. And yet they do. I assume they're not making it up. And I'm convinced that's the way righteous people are, if they're going about serving because it's the right thing to do and not because they're keeping track. Can you imagine somebody say, oh, well, Sister Bertha's had a death in the family. I'm going to make a bowl of spaghetti and take over there to help out. And I got my little notebook here and I see bowl of spaghetti. I'm sure that's worth 5 points with God. And on the day of judgment, he's going to open the book of life and go look there and say, ah, bowl of spaghetti. Yes, that's another feather in my cap. And that kind of person who keeps track of that kind of thing, they're the kind of person that 30 years later, the person comes and says, oh, I want to thank you so much. I'll never forget that. And say, well, it's took you long enough. It's been 30 years, 6 days, 2 hours, and 10 seconds. See, righteous people don't keep track of stuff like that. Now, my guarantee to you is, on the day of judgment, you're going to be shocked at just how much value God places on simple acts of kindness that you may not even remember doing. How a simple bowl of spaghetti may have extraordinary consequences. Not because it's a great bowl of spaghetti, but because God in His wisdom and power can take that simple bowl of spaghetti and cause the rise and fall of nations. Wouldn't you be shocked on the day of judgment to find out 10,000 people became Christians because of that bowl of spaghetti? You'd be like, no, it wasn't that good of spaghetti. But again, it's not you, it's what God can do with a bowl of spaghetti. Right? And you're going to be shocked. Now you say, well, wait a minute, now I'm not going to be shocked. That's like telling somebody, I'm going to give you a surprise birthday party Saturday, 12 o'clock, right here, and here's all the stuff we're going to be doing. Not going to be very surprising, because you've told them all up front, right? But I'll tell you, even knowing ahead of time how shocked you're going to be, you're still going to be shocked. Because I think like throwing a rock in a pond and the ripples that go outward from that, we have no clue the extent to which a simple act of kindness can impact the lives of other people for good. And just as surely, we do have no clue how one simple little sin can have devastating consequences for people far beyond what we imagined was going to happen. And so the righteous are shocked. We're going to find ourselves shocked on the day of judgment that God looks at those simple acts of kindness, that God's going to look at Sister Lucy's pie and say, that was a great pie. That was a wonderful thing that she was doing or trying to do. But those stupid college kids wouldn't let her because they didn't understand what it means to serve rather than be served and be served on their terms. But lest I leave too ill an impression of Ball State College students from Christian homes in the state of Indiana, I will end with this story. There was one young lady that came to us from Maryland to go to college at Ball State. Extraordinary young lady. Again, lots of wonderful, good young people. But she stands out from all the rest because one day she comes up, she says, how can I get my name on the list to clean the building? And she had been taught by her parents, you're there to serve and not to be served. And we need more young people like her. I'm here to serve, like my Lord came to serve and not to be served. And that's what service is about. That's what Jesus is about. And that's what we need to be about as well. At this time, we're going to sing an invitation song as we think about our relationship with the Lord. And if there is some way we can truly serve you, to understand what your needs are and to help you with those, to find the true happiness in serving God and serving your fellow man, because that's what it means to follow Jesus. We're here to help you in any way that we can. You just let us know what it is we can do for you, even right now, tonight, while we stand and while we sing the song.